Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Time for another edition of Garden Talk. And today we take a look at how you can incorporate prairie and other native plants into your landscape. Neil DeBoe is president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. He has an international reputation for the work that he's done in the prairie area, and we're really glad to have him as kind of a regular guest who comes by every so often to talk with us about what's going on in that area and certainly to answer your questions, and I hope you'll join us. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Maybe you've got a favorite native plant, or maybe a native area, or maybe you'd like to have a native area. Those are a couple of things that we can talk about with him. And certainly, again, join us at 800-642-1234. Neil, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
How large an area do you need?
For it to put in a nice little prairie, you can have 100 acres or you can have 100 square feet or you can have a few square feet. It really depends on what kind of situation you want to create. For people that have limited area, and a lot of us have urban lots, and we don't have 100 acres or 1 acre, you can create a beautiful prairie garden that has lots of nice flowers, grasses, maybe a couple of small shrubs, because there are a few shrubs that grow on the prairie. And those plants, depending on which ones you pick, will bring in a plethora of birds, butterflies, hummingbirds, and all kinds of insects and really cool garden visitors.
And, you know, a bit of work to get it started.
Depends on what you're starting with.
Yeah.
If you have a lawn, it's pretty easy to get rid of a lawn. There's a lot of ways to do that. You can smother it on a small area. And a lot of people put down newspapers. You ever do that in the wind? Yeah, been there, done that. Not worth it. No, and we only have so much time. So it's Sunday, and that's your afternoon, and the wind is blowing, or it's raining, or who knows, maybe it's snowing in May. But an easy way is you go to a store that sells appliances and see if you can get a hold of some of their big cardboard appliance boxes and put that over your lawn. And then you cover a big area, put some rocks on it or some logs or something, leave it there. Usually, if the lawn doesn't have a lot of weeds, you can kill a lawn in usually about 2 months of smothering. Mm-hmm. But if you have a lot of weeds, you might want to leave it there all year for a growing season, from April through, say, September. And then you can go and put in your plants in the fall. Okay.
Oh.
Or you can do it starting in July or August with just a lawn, if you don't have a lot of weeds, and get ready for next spring. So in the middle of the summer, put your cardboard down, let it kill the lawn off for July, August, September, October, and just leave it there over the winter. Take the cardboard up in the winter, and you're ready to put your plants in.
Yeah, in the spring, take them.
That's correct, yes. And another thing is, oftentimes the cardboard gets kind of soggy by then. You can just dig a little hole in the cardboard, put the plant in the soil.
There you go.
And the cardboard serves as your mulch. Easy breezy, simple.
And not very expensive.
Not very expensive.
Yep. Little gas to get to the store to get the box.
It's a low budget, low environmental impact program. If you have a larger area, then you can, you get a lot of boxes. Or you can use Roundup herbicide, but a lot of people don't want to use herbicides on their properties. Mm-hmm. And so there are other methods. You can till it, but that's a lot of work. If you've ever tilled like a lawn, the rototiller just bounces off of it, and it's really a pain, and then you have all the sod. The nice thing about this smothering method is it allows the sod to break down during the time when it's being smothered, so when you go to work in there, it's not this big, thick, massive roots. By then, it started to deteriorate, so it's much easier to work in.
Oh, sounds great to me. I'm ready to go.
Okay. Spring is coming.
Dan in Montfort has a comment or question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I have a north-facing hillside that I ran a road down in, and I disturbed the soil, and I'm wondering if there's any native seeds that you guys have that I could spread along this road that's north-facing hillside that maybe would be natural in the timbers and that won't be invasive to the timber and that would maybe help the erosion and make the timber pretty.
Sure. Let me ask you a couple of questions, Dan. Is the area, you say there's timber, so is the area pretty heavily shaded?
Yes, it is. It's pretty shaded.
Okay, and what kind of soil do you have there?
What kind of what?
What kind of soil?
It's clay, sand. It's southwest Wisconsin here, so it's a lot of sand, it looks like, and clay.
Okay, so you have usually sand on top and clay underneath, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Yep. That's not uncommon. Okay. And is it a steep slope or is it a fairly gradual slope? How much chance for erosion?
It's little bit of both. Some of it's really steep and okay. big slope, and some of it's more level.
Okay. One of the things you'll find is that when it comes to woodland plants, it's much more difficult to produce seeds of woodland plants for a number of reasons. If you compare them to our prairie flowers and grasses, first of all, they like sun, so they do well in a production field that's wide open and sunny. So most of your prairie plants, with some exceptions, are easily produced on a large scale. So the cost of those seeds is relatively reasonable. Mm-hmm. Many of your woodland plants are spring ephemerals. Their seeds ripen early. They're only a foot tall. You can't bring the combine in through the woods. Yeah. It's kind of a problem. And they're much more difficult to produce. And some of them are, you have to keep them moist or the seeds will go into deep dormancy. So there's all kinds of issues with working with those seeds. So there's not as many seeds available of woodland plants as there are prairie plants. So that's one of the problems we run into when we're restoring areas in woodlands, is the limitation of the species and the cost of the seed. The cost of the woodland plants, because of the cost of production being so much higher, you're limited. There are some other options for you. You can use some of the woodland grasses. In a situation like yours where you're looking primarily at just restoration of the area or soil stabilization, is that your primary goal here, Dan?
Yeah, and try to maybe keep the garlic mustard from growing in too.
Oh, boy. Well, that's a whole other story. we could spend a whole show on garlic mustard. But let me give you a suggestion. There is a woodland grass that's very reasonably priced. It's called Virginia Wild Rye. And that grows in the shade, and it grows in your soil type. There's also another grass that grows in the shade and in a variety of soil types, any decent soil, and that is called bottlebrush grass. Now, unfortunately, bottlebrush grass is significantly more expensive than the Virginia wild rye. So if you're just looking at covering the area and getting good establishment, then I think you should look at the possibility of using the Virginia wild rye. Now, normally, we don't like to plant a monoculture, but if budget is a concern, you may just have to work with that one grass, the Virginia wild rye. And I would put it on at about 20 pounds per acre.
20 pounds per acre.
Yep, and that should give you pretty good cover and get you going. It grows really relatively fast, so it should give you rapid soil stabilization. And the best time to plant that is either in September or in late April or May.
Okay, thank you.
You
All
bet.
Right.
Good luck.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Terry in Partyville, we're on to you now. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I planted no mow grass a year ago in the fall, and I ditched my whole yard before I did it, and it was almost 5 acres of property. So I bought a lot of seed from you, gentlemen. I can't remember your first name, Steve, is it?
Neil.
I'm sorry, but I bought the seed, and I wondered what I should fertilize that with. I also planted about 4 acres of wildflowers, and I wondered if I should burn those this year. They're about 10 years they've been growing, and they're getting kind of spotty.
Okay, what kind of mix did you use for your wildflower mix?
I purchased it from your store. I don't recall exactly what the mix was.
Okay,
it's
so
hard fescue. I'm not sure beyond that.
Okay, now in the prairie mix, that was one of our mixes that you used?
Actually, the prairie mix that was purchased from S&S Wildflowers over by Partyville.
Okay, so that was probably prairie grasses and prairie flowers, correct?
Yeah, it's got 10 different flowers in it, I think, and grasses.
Okay, got it. Well, let me ask you answer your first question first as far as the no-mow grass. Generally, if your soil has decent fertility and it doesn't take much, you generally will not have to fertilize at all. And that's one of the great advantages of our no-mow fescue lawn mix is, number one, you don't have to fertilize it because the fescue grasses are inherently low in their requirements for nitrogen. So it's a really great environmental option to a traditional lawn because your Kentucky bluegrass typically requires a much higher level of nitrogen to look good, whereas the fescues do not. And that's one of the reasons why we selected those when we designed this blend. We spent quite a few years evaluating different mixes before we came up with this about 15 years ago. And because it doesn't require high levels of nitrogen, generally there's absolutely no need to fertilize it unless you are on absolutely basically pure sand. That would be the exception. And you have a lot of other issues too, like lime, phosphorus, potassium, that you have to deal with when you're on really, really like blow sand. But if you have anything approaching normal sandy loam, loamy sand, loam, you should be fine as far as fertilizing, not necessary at all. As far as your prairie, what we have found in all the work that I've been doing the last 30 years on prairies, is if you burn your prairie every other year, If you can do that, that maintains a very good balance between the flowers and the grasses. And if you don't burn your prairie, it's going to be invaded by cool season grasses and weeds, which is probably what you're experiencing. And because cool season grasses and weeds like quackgrass and bluegrass and clover, these begin growth usually 4 to 6 weeks before most of your warm season prairie plants. So they get the jump on them at the beginning of the year, and they don't really relinquish that. And that's why we burn, and the timing of the burning is essential. If you burn in March, it will do absolutely nothing. The generally best time to burn is between April 15th and May 1st in southern and central Wisconsin. And that will then set back those cool season weeds and grasses, because they will already be up 4, 5, 6 inches tall, and you will deprive them of that new growth after you burn it back. The soil turns black, then the temperature of the soil increases rapidly after you burn it, favoring the warm season prairie plants. It's just like magic. It's truly, truly amazing. So I would get in there and start burning that prairie around in Partyville. You can push it all the way into the last week in April. It's hard to say because every spring is different. What we use as a guide is the sugar maple tree. When the buds of the sugar maple tree are just opening, that's your best time to burn.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad I called today.
All right. Well, I'm glad you did too. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Bye.
Appreciate it, Terry. Yeah. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org as we talk with Neil DeBole, president of Prairie Nursery in Westvale, Wisconsin, as we visit with him about incorporating prairie and other native plants into your landscape. Again, 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. I have an email. I have a small, very shaded spot next to the house that I'd like to plant with natives. What might work well? The soil might be poor because I just took a serviceberry bush out.
Okay. There are a lot of wonderful woodland plants, and it would take forever here to go through all the different choices for you. So what I would encourage you to do is to take a look at our website.
Yes.
Or to
get your catalog.
Get a catalog. And we have our plants in our catalog organized by sun and shade, and the prairie plants are organized by soil type, sandy soils, clay soils, moist soils. And our woodland plants are in a separate section, so you can pick the ones that are best for you. So if you'd like a catalog, you can go online to our website and just check out what we've got at www.prairienursery.com. And prairie is a tricky word. It's a French word. Even I misspell it, and I've been doing this 30 years. P-R-A-I-R-I-E. www.prairienursery.com. Or you can give us a call if you'd rather call at 1-800-476-9453. We'd be happy to send you a catalog. It's a nice color catalog, and it has a wide variety of plants for shaded areas.
Yeah, it's a beautiful catalog. Again, that's 800-476-9453 or prairienursery.com, and you're going to enjoy looking at it. I can tell you right now, I just sort of salivate as I look through the various plants that you have, and you see you got some butterflies attached to a few of them, and that's just, I assume, to let people know that, this is a good plant for...
Yes, absolutely. And you'll see under each plant, we have a set of icons that tell you, does it attract butterflies? Does it attract birds? Does it make a good cut flower? Is it deer resistant? All kinds of situations. There's a lot of plants that attract hummingbirds, and those are marked. And what I'm finding is, every year I do a little more research, or every year I'm out in the garden, I say, wow, look at that. There's a hummingbird on that flower? I didn't know they went to that. And what is amazing is how many of these native plants the hummingbirds will go to.
Oh.
It's absolutely stunning. And every year I learn something new out there. So, and our catalog actually doesn't even tell you. We have to update it some more because we just keep finding more and more plants that the hummingbirds and various other garden visitors will come to.
Neil DeBole, president of Prairie Nursery. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Neil DeBole of Prairie Nursery, our guest today. And Neil, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about bees and wasps and their importance.
Yes, this is something that I think people have really undervalued in their gardens. And they think, well, bees and wasps, all they do is sting you and they're really bad. But in fact, there are very few aggressive bees and wasps. And in the 29 years that I have worked in my nursery, I have never once been stung by a bumblebee or a honeybee. Because, well, you know, for a honeybee, that's death.
Yeah.
Okay? And they're basically very docile, wonderful creatures. And only if you step on them or whack them or do something that really antagonizes them will they bother you. And actually, the number one pollinator, and that, well, that I know of, there's all these insects that you, are almost microscopic. This is amazing diversity. But the bumblebee is an incredibly important pollinator for us. And they're wonderful, wonderful creatures. And, of course, theoretically, they should not be able to fly. But they defy. They didn't read the book. They still are able to fly. But what is becoming increasingly understood and appreciated is the fact that there are all these different native bees. And with the decline that we're seeing in honeybees, which is actually a European import. Well, there are different strains of honeybees, but it's not a native bee. With the decline in honeybees, it's becoming increasingly important that our native bees be available for pollinating plants, crops, etc. In fact, there are many people, the cranberry growers, are experimenting now with alternative bees to honeybees because of the colony collapse problem. So there's all these fabulous little bees that we don't know, mostly because they're small. And they don't bother us, so we really take very little note of them. But if you just park yourself by some of those prairie plants, you know, crack a brewski and sit out there and watch the bees. Well, it's not a lot to do in Westfield, you know. So that's pretty good entertainment in my book. And even more interesting in some regards are the wasps. And a lot of people say, ooh, wasps, they sting me. But if you look at it, what is the worst wasp of the whole group? Which is the one you're most likely to get stung by? The yellow jacket. Mm-hmm. Okay, and there are two species. There's a native yellow jacket, and then there's the German yellow jacket, which was imported here accidentally. And these are truly aggressive wasps. And then you got your mud daubers and all sorts of other wasps that will sting you, but they usually will not bother you unless you bother them. Mm-hmm. Hornets, you never get stung by a hornet unless you go throw a rock at the nest, right?
Yeah.
So you leave them alone, they leave you alone. But what's really fascinating are there are all these much smaller predaceous wasps that we never see, and there are hundreds of them. And they attack and harm or kill a lot of the pests in our garden that attack our garden plants. And, in fact, we have one customer who had problems with tomato hornworm every single year in his garden. And he planted one of our prairie mixes right next to it. And once that prairie matured and he started getting flowers, his tomato hornworms went away.
Oh.
And he said, my prairie is my pesticide. Why was that? Undoubtedly, he had predaceous wasps that were living in his prairie, and they attacked the tomato hornworms and kept their populations in control. So it was really just a biocontrol method, a natural biocontrol. So it's a great thing. And I can't, at my house, I never have any problems with potato beetles anymore. Now, is that because I have prairies all around my house? I can't prove that. I have no data to prove that. But it might be good circumstantial evidence, Your Honor. But check out wasps. Wasps are really pretty amazing, and some of them are pretty cool. So they're small. You never see them. They don't bother you, 99% of them. But they do amazing things in the garden.
Well worth considering and keeping in mind. Dave in Wanakee has a question for you.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I'd like to transplant two burning bushes this spring. Is that advisable or...
Well, I'll tell you what. I don't know much about burning bushes because they're not native. But generally speaking, when you're working with woody plants, most of the time you are best advised to transplant them in the spring. And you want to transplant them before they begin growth because you want to work with the plant while it's still dormant, because once the leaves come out, they're putting pressure on the roots for moisture and nutrients. So if you can get to that before the leaves come out, after the soil thaws, get out there and transplant that woody plant, whether it's a bush or a small tree or whatever. Get it before the leaves come out. And generally speaking, on a bush, you're probably going to want to prune it back because there will be some root damage.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, I mean, most bushes, you can prune them right back to the ground, okay, and just the root transplant, and you'll be good to go. For instance, lilacs, okay? I have a lilac. Somebody planted a lilac at my house a million years ago. Who knows how old that plant is? And they start to get a little out of control, a little gangly, so every 10 years I just take the chainsaw to it, take it right down to the ground. Comes a couple years later, it's blooming, it looks great. This is what we call, you know, strategic pruning. So they're pretty tough. Now, again, I don't know the specifics on burning bush, but this is pretty much universal for most shrubs. So good luck.
There you go, Dave. Thanks for calling. Doug in Fond du Lac, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Larry and Neil. I got a question on weed control in a large prairie. Many years ago, I had a 30-acre parcel, put in big blue Indian grass, switchgrass, and then the flowers. And I just ran into a huge problem, especially with Canadian goldenrod.
Mm.
And the old farmer in me, I couldn't take seeing thistles and the goldenrod, so I went out and sprayed it.
Yeah, it was like 2,4-D or something like that.
Yeah,
yep.
Yeah, it did a beautiful job of taking care of everything.
Yep.
And then the grasses came in great, and since then I've been doing a burn, but there was so much Canadian goldenrod around. I don't know if starting a burn earlier would have helped me. Is there another way to kind of manage it? Do you want to tell me my theory? Is to go in and plant just the grasses, spray for a couple years, and then go in, you know, 2-3 years later and do like a fall planting of the flowers. Would something like that work?
Absolutely. Your theory has been proven previously. Let's start with the beginning. You have the number one worst weed we get in our prairies.
Oh.
Canada goldenrod. And you know what? Canada goldenrod is a native plant. It didn't come from Canada. They didn't send it to us as a nasty little present. It is a native plant, and it creeps by rhizomes. It's the seeds fly all over the place. It will come from miles away and just to get in your prairie and wreck it. It is the worst doggone plant. And there's nothing you can do. Burning, we've experimented, and lots of my friends have experimented with different timing of burning, with mowing procedures. Nobody that I know of has figured out a way to control it without herbicides. Now, if somebody out there listening has figured out a way, please, please call now.
I'll tell you what I do right now that works great. And again, this is many years into it. But I went in, I sprayed for, you know, probably 2 years in a row.
Yeah.
You know, if I started to see it, that's the only time I would spray.
Mm-hmm.
But since that point, I've been doing a yearly burn.
Oh, yeah.
And so for the last 5 years, I haven't had to spray. I just burn, and I've got a beautiful, but it's only a stand of the tall grasses.
Right.
I mean, I love big blue and Indian grass, but it'd be nice to kind of see some of the purple coneflower and some of the other things.
Yeah, your annual burning is going to typically favor your big, tall, warm season grasses like big blue stem switchgrass, Indian grass. And that method right there is going to tend to keep out a lot of other plants. Plus the fact that you eliminated the Canada goldenrod by spraying it, that puts you in a very good position. Now, going back to your theory, which is a proven theory, of planting the grasses first and spraying them with herbicide for 1 or 2 years, with a broadleaf only, of course,
right,
and then putting in flowers later, it does work. However, if you're going to do that, plant the grasses in the spring, because your warm season grasses do not typically do well with a fall seeding, which is a dormant seeding. They sit in the ground over the winter, and they will come up the next spring. We have much lower germination rates and lower establishment rates when we plant the warm season grasses in the fall. The flowers, on the other hand, do much better when seeded in the fall, because many of them have seed dormancies that require experiencing a cold, damp period in the soil. So when weather warms up in the spring, they've been triggered to germinate because they know, okay, it's spring, now I'm ready to go. So plant your warm season grasses in May or June. You can plant them all the way up until June 30th. Some people plant them all the way up to July 15th. That gets a little risky because you've only got a half of your growing season left to establish a good root system. So plant them in May or June. Usually when farmers start planting corn, that's when you plant your prairie grasses.
Yeah.
Then, at the end of the first growing season, after you've had one or two applications of the broadleaf herbicide, you can put in your flowers as a fall dormant seeding, which is the best time for the flowers. Or you can spend 2 years controlling any broadleaf weeds with your application of the broadleaf and then plant the flower seed in the fall of the second growing season. By the time you get to the third growing season, the grasses will be so well established, there will be very little open soil for the flowers to become established, and it will be much more expensive because you'll have to use more seed and you will get a much lower establishment rate. So if you're going to use this method, plant your flowers either in the fall of the first growing season or the fall of the second growing season. After the third year,
There you go.
So your theory is true.
Thanks, Doug. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. All right. We had an email question. Are there natives that are good for cut flower bouquets?
I'm sorry, what was that again?
Are there native plants that are good for cut flower bouquets?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, if you look at our catalog, we have an icon for cut flowers and for dried arrangements. So there are many, many, many of them. There are a few that are not, okay? But the vast majority of them look great in cut flowers and hold up really, really well. In fact, when I first started growing these plants in 1982, all of the plants that I grow were considered weeds. And the local farmers called us the weed farm. Neil, I spend thousands of dollars a year killing weeds, and you're growing them. I had my farmer neighbor over. We took a walk, and he didn't find any of his weeds in my nursery. But I will tell you this. Thank God for the purple coneflower. Because the purple coneflower was the first of our native prairie plants that was elevated from the status of wildflower to perennial. Now, once you break that barrier to perennial, you're in some high cotton there. So I say, well, purple coneflower, that is the Jackie Robinson of prairie plants because it broke the weed barrier. So we love the purple coneflower.
There are a lot of other ones.
There are a lot of other ones. But there are many, many, many flowers. And again, if you get one of our catalogs, you'll see that they're listed. There are a few like the spiderwort, which only blooms in the morning. It closes in the afternoon. You cut it in the morning, put it in water, and it's done. It'll never open up again. So you want to be careful, but most of these will make great cut flowers.
Gene in Green Bay, we are on to you. Hi, Gene.
Hello. I know this is going to sound really strange. You had asked if anybody knows how to get rid of goldenrod. I live near railroad tracks, and I'm allergic to the stuff. It just gets, the powder gets in your eyes. It gets everywhere. The wind would come by, and your clothes would turn yellow. So I went out there, and I thought, I'm going to try something. And I cut a plant down. I knew that wasn't going to help because the roots are still there, but I poured vinegar. I poured a whole bottle of vinegar down there. And I stayed there a couple of years. That plant did not grow, but the other ones, I took Clearasil, which is menthol and eucalyptus.
Yeah.
And I put it in a bottle, and I didn't dilute it. I sprayed the heck out of one plant, and that plant died.
Wow. And it had and it had no acne.
No, Clearasil, and it's, you know, natural to the environment. Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know. I mean, it's fairly inexpensive. I mean, it's natural. It's not going to hurt anybody. And hey,
now let me ask you a question. You cut the plant down to the ground, correct?
That one died. Yeah, I poured vinegar. That one, the roots, I poked a spoon in there and I made sure, you know, and I poured vinegar.
Okay, and you poured it onto the stump of the cut plant after you cut it. Okay.
Right, and it never grew. So it never grew the next spring. It never grew up.
So the vinegar and or the Clearasil went down into the plant through the cut.
Just the vinegar.
Oh, just the vinegar.
And then the other plant that I tried, you know, well, I did them sparsely because, you know, they grow in, like, great big clumps. So I did them, like, separate ones, you know, that weren't so far because, you know, they have the seeds and then they grow and they grow. And so then I took another one and that was, you know, further away, and I sprayed the heck out of that with Clearasil and I poured vinegar in the ground, and that one just withered and died.
So you sprayed the Clearasil on the leaves, correct?
Yeah, all over the place. Wow. I sprayed the whole thing.
You are a great backyard pioneering scientist. This is wonderful news. So for people that have limited infestations, here's an alternative to herbicides. Now in large areas, that would be a lot of Clearasil or a lot of vinegar.
There you go. Thanks, Gene.
Thank you, Gene. That's wonderful news.
We have Lucy in Milwaukee up next with a question for your comment. Hi, Lucy. We lose Lucy? I think we might have lost Lucy. Well, let's go to Troy then. Troy in Lake Geneva. Hello.
Hi, how are you both?
Good. Thank you for calling.
Listen, I'm pretty slow going, but I've been preparing a hillside for my wife on a house we bought about 4 years ago, like a bonsai tree. I got rid of all of the sticky little weeds, and then I got rid of a lot of the prickly weeds, and I sprayed it carefully and had my nephew come by last fall and really, really tear it up with some big tines and a tractor. So I've got a hillside, all sun. I've got what I would call a sandy soil, and underneath that just a lot of gravel, so a lot of drainage. I'd like a little retention so I don't have, you know, my whole hill start to slide away. And it's about an acre, mm-hmm. and my wife loves purple flowers. Mm-hmm. I love anything that's orange. Mm-hmm. And so I've got it all prepped. I haven't gone out there with the final, you know, tines on a tractor or wheels that will really, really take it down to something. It's a lot of lumps out there now. But I'd like to, you know, finalize the soil, and then I haven't used any insecticides. So there's plenty of bugs and worms out there, but I just don't know what to do. I don't know what to plant. I don't know what kind of flowers or grasses to mix up.
Okay. Well, you have a couple of choices. One is you can use a standard prairie mix, and we have a wide variety of different mixes already designed, and there are mixes for dry sandy soils, mixes for clay soils, mixes for damp soils, short ones, tall ones, low-growing ones, a wide variety, and we have a special butterfly mix. And we have a diverse mix, which is kind of like the kitchen sink mix, mm-hmm. where you throw just about everything in there, tall, short, all kinds of different heights and different colors. The second choice for you, rather than using a standard pre-designed mix, is you can design your own mix, or you can call us, and we'll be happy to put together a mix for you.
That would be great. And again, as far as the soil retention and combined with, I guess, you know, a few colors that we like.
Yeah,
sure. The blooms are important, meaning we'd like to see blooms either sequentially all season long or
yep.
something that's blooming. Is that what the mix does? And then the last question, you know, how many pounds for a whole acre when you're talking about a mix between flowers and some grasses?
Okay, great questions. Yes, the mixes that we have are already designed very carefully to give you succession of bloom. And the nice thing about a prairie is that you have flowers from usually starting about mid-spring all the way into the fall. And you have a lot of asters that will give you color, in many cases, all the way into November, like the New England aster.
Yeah,
that thing will bloom the first, second week of November. And what's really cool about the New England aster is it's the last chance cafe for migrating monarch butterflies. It's one
great.
Of the last flowers blooming, and they will utilize that. And that's just one example. There are many, many other asters that they'll use as well. So you can, again, go with a pre-designed mix, or we can put something together for you. And then what was your second question on that?
Well, now it's a matter of logistics. Let's say this weekend I come and visit you. Do I lay the seeds down while it's still damp out and a little cold and then till that into the hillside and hope for the best this spring, or do I not rush into everything right now? Can I buy the seeds and sit on it for a couple weeks and just throw them on top of the soil that hasn't been tilled?
One thing about prairies is never, never rush. Take your time. Make sure all the weeds are dead. Has everything been completely killed on this site?
Like I said, 4 years.
Okay, you're in good shape. Okay.
Like a bonsai tree trimmer.
Sounds like you're ready to go.
Yeah.
Okay. You don't want to throw, well, there's a couple different ways to do this. Some people will do what we call a frost seeding, and they will go out this time of year, just as the snow is starting to go, and put the seed right on top of the soil, or even right on top of a couple of inches of soil. And the seed will work its way down into the ground.
With the rains, you mean?
Well, with rains and frost heaving. This is the time of year when you have maximum frost heaving, because in the daytime the soil thaws,
mm-hmm.
and at night it freezes. It's called a freeze-thaw cycle.
Makes sense.
And so the soil actually opens up its little pores, and so the seed will settle into those pores, and it'll freeze at night and thaw in the day, and the seed will just settle itself in really nicely. You want to be careful, though. Generally not recommended to go put your seed on top of 1, 2, 3 feet of snow, because if you get a big snow melt event, the seed goes away.
Yeah.
Like it'll wash right down the hillside. So you want to usually do this just as the snow is coming off of your soil. One thing you want to be careful about, though, is if your soil is still rough from the tilling or harrowing that your friend did,
mm-hmm.
you will not have a smooth surface. And one of the ways that we manage our prairies in the first couple of years is to mow them to keep weeds down. So you're going to want to have a pretty level surface before you put the seed down.
Okay.
And again, you have until June 30th to get the seed in. So I would say take your time, make sure everything's under control, that you've got a nice level seed bed, and then plant your seed. But I would not just throw the seed on the surface of the soil in a spring seeding. You want to work the ground and then rake it in after you put the seed down. And do not take equipment out there to put that seed in, because it'll bury it too deeply. When I say equipment, I mean like a tiller or something. That'll just put the seed way under the ground. It'll never see the light of day, and you'll have wasted your money. You just want to lightly rake it in. Now, as an alternative, we talked about throwing the seed on the surface in March, early March. By the time you get to later March, you're not going to have the frost heaving, because you're not going to have necessarily the freezing at night. So this is something you normally will do in late February, early March. Now is the perfect time of year to do that. If you're doing a fall seeding, you can actually scatter the seed on the surface, and it will also go through the freeze-thaw cycle in December a little bit, maybe some even in January sometimes, and then, of course, in February and March. So that is also another option for you. But if you're doing a seeding in April, May, June, when there's no more frost...
I like the options. I mean, it's nice to know I can do this up till June 30th. I could do it now. I could do it in the fall. And last question, where is the city that you're located in, the name of your store again?
We're in Westfield, and we're actually a mail-order company. So we can ship it to you. You can come to our store. But if you're dealing with a large mix or a special custom mix, we would have to talk to you about that in advance and prepare your order for you.
Are you online?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And what's your website?
PrairieNursery.com, www.PRAIRIENursery.com. And you can call us, 1-800-476-9400. 5-3, and we do a lot of custom mix designs to mix the kind of colors you want.
My wife would be thrilled with that. Neil and Larry, thank you both.
All right.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot for calling, Troy. Appreciate it. And you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. Email from Dennis. We have several planted prairies on our farm in southwest Wisconsin. We have Baptista alba of the wild indigo growing in a prairie that seems like it's becoming aggressive. Any suggestions on controlling it, or should we just let it go and see if it stabilizes?
Well, I wish I had Baptista alba getting aggressive in my prairie. I love that plant. This is really interesting. And how old is it? Do we know?
No.
Okay. What you'll see, I bet it's probably at least 7, 8, 10 years old.
Yeah, I bet.
Because the indigos, the wild indigos, Baptisia, are what we call, quote-unquote, climax prairie plants, meaning that they are part of the long-term plant community. And when you plant a prairie mix, you will have what we call early successional species. This is the concept of plant succession.
Mm-hmm.
So the first few years, quite frankly, the first year of a prairie seeding, it's going to look like a mess. It's going to be all weeds. Okay, and why is that? That's because our native prairie plants, with very few exceptions, are perennials. And that's one of the great advantages, is because they're going to come back year after year after year. And once a prairie mix is planted and you get a prairie, you'll never have to replant it.
Yeah.
That's
great.
That's really good. And if you amortize the cost of that prairie over its lifetime, which could be 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, 200 years, you know, depending how long it hangs around, your cost per year is really, really low, because every year it just comes back year after year. So what you'll find is in the second year, the biennials in your prairie mix, maybe it's some black-eyed Susans or some dotted mints, these will show up in the second year, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, okay, maybe everything's going to be okay after all. Okay, after that first year of weeds. And I can't tell you how many people lose heart the first year. Like, oh, my God. And, of course, we tell everybody it takes 3 years. Got to wait 3 years, because that's when your early successional perennials start to show up. So what's an early successional perennial? That's like the purple coneflower, the bergamot, the yellow coneflower. These are the plants that grow relatively rapidly. And then they show up usually in the third year. So we tell people 3 years, the black-eyed Susans show up the second year, everybody's happy, you know, under-promise, over-deliver. And then about starting in year 5, 6, 7, that's when your long-lived, slow-growing plants like the Baptisias or the indigo show up, the compass plant, the prairie dock. That's when these plants show up, and these have these big, huge, giant roots, and these plants can live 50, 70, 100 years. Nobody really knows.
No.
So they're long-term players. So that's what you're seeing, and the White Falls indigos are really getting established, and I would just love them because it's a beautiful plant.
There you go. Let's go to Jim in Onalaska. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Yeah, Dr. Terebinthinaceum. with some of my own work that I've done in the field and looking at, like, Curtis's Vegetation of Wisconsin and stuff like that, there appears to be a pretty strong gradient when you go from the southwestern part of Wisconsin to the northeastern part of Wisconsin and the oak openings of number of prairie species. You know, there's a heck of a lot of them in the southwest, and the farther northeast you go, the fewer the species.
Yep.
And I'm just wondering if, in terms of people planting prairies, if that same thing occurs, that they end up having less species in the northeastern part, or if, you know, it doesn't really matter. We're planting them, and you're going to grow there.
Well, there's two aspects to your question, or comment, actually. First of all, there's more species in southwestern Wisconsin because there's more left in southwestern Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And there are very few prairie remnants in northeastern Wisconsin. And I used to live in Green Bay, and my friends and I, we'd spend our time over. This was a good time for us on a Saturday, was to go walk the railroad tracks to look at the prairie plants. Wow, everybody else, you know, chasing girls in the bars, we're walking the prairie plants. So, and what is really fascinating is there is a tremendous diversity of the prairie plants if you know where to find them in northeastern Wisconsin. And in fact, the prairies extended all the way up into Marinette County and into the UP. And there are some people that believe that the prairies, actually there were prairies in southern Ontario too, and there are people, the people that figured this stuff out, figured that the prairie migrated along northeastern Wisconsin, across the UP, into Ontario, and possibly even other areas, but this is all kind of hard to prove. But there are extensive prairies in the Green Bay area, Kaukauna area, Oshkosh area, but you never see them because they're not large like some of the remnants that we have in southwestern Wisconsin. But southwestern Wisconsin had a lot more prairie than northeastern Wisconsin to start with. And what we also find is these plants are very flexible. And usually the distribution of the plants is often just a subject of chance. Was there a seed source? Was it distributed? Did Native Americans take it there and grow it? We find places in Green Bay where there were really significant Indian encampments, and you'll find plants that are disjunct from their other populations by 100 or 200 miles because they use them for dye plants or food plants, and they would bring them with them, and they would grow them at their encampments. So the plant distribution is a function of many factors, animals, wind, water, people. So you'll see a lot of variation. And most of these plants, you can move them around, and they will do just fine as long as they're in the climate and the type of soil that they like.
There you go, Jim. Thank you very much for calling. Neil DeBull, our guest today. He is president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Neil DeBull of Prairie Nursery, our guest. We put a link for Neil's store on my Facebook page on the Larry Mueller Show, so you can get to that. And we linked also from the status update for the show. And I also will put it on Larry's link, so you'll have it there as well. Jennifer in Appleton has a question for you. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. Great show. I was wondering, I have dozens of deer that come through my yard and daily devastate basically all of my flowers. I'm looking for native prairie flowers that are deer resistant. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. There are a number of prairie plants and prairie flowers that are deer resistant. And in general, the deer do not eat the grasses. They like the flowers.
Okay.
Now, with the exception of our no-mow grass, all winter long, all fall, when my friends come to hunt, where's the deer? Well, they're hiding in the corn until the corn comes off, or they're hiding in the marsh because they know the hunters are there. And I'm talking not just gun hunters, bow hunters. And they're out there the first week in January in their tree stands, and it's 10 below zero and the wind is blowing, but they're out there. I don't know how they do it. But this time of year, as the snow melts, the deer come and eat my, they're right in my yard. They're eating all my normal grass. It doesn't hurt it, but it's the only thing green because it stays green. So I know how you feel. They sleep in our yard, and if the plants are not resistant, they will eat them. So you want to be very selective, although it's surprising how many of the flowers are deer resistant. Now let's be clear what deer resistant is. It is not deer proof. It means it is a secondary or tertiary choice, and a hungry enough deer will eat darn near anything. But also you'll see that in our catalog and on our website, the icon will tell you if it is a deer-resistant plant. But the kinds of plants that deer don't like are ones that are strongly scented, like the mints, onions, or plants that have really furry leaves that just, as you say in the food industry, they have bad mouthfeel.
Mouthfeel, yeah.
Okay, and they're all hairy or something or and such and such. But they don't seem to bother with the thorns on some roses. They'll eat those just fine. I don't know how they do it, but that's Bambi's deal. So you want to be selective. And again, if you have herds and herds of deer, then that's going to be really tough. But we live on the Serengeti at our house, and my prairies are doing just fine. I don't have a lot of asters because they like most of the asters, especially the New England aster and the sky blue aster. But there are other asters that they don't bother at all. So it's very interesting to see which ones they select and which ones they don't. They generally like the prairie clovers, which is a legume. But they don't bother the Baptisias. And maybe that's what's happening at the other gentlemen's. Maybe they ate all this prairie clover and they don't like the Baptisia, so I don't know. But check out what the availability, what the susceptibility of the plants are, and you can see that by looking at our catalog or on our website.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. I got an email from Donna. Right now I have a lot of low evergreens getting overgrown and spindly around the foundation of my house. Are there any good native plants that can be used for foundation plantings, get rid of the evergreens? If so, which ones? My door faces east.
Okay. Foundation plantings, generally speaking, we're looking at low-growing shrubs. Like in your case, probably have some junipers and something like that, which are commonly used for foundation plantings. There are many different ways you can handle this. If you will be willing to consider something other than low-growing shrubs. And there are some native low-growing shrubs, but there are a lot of really wonderful prairie flowers and grasses you could use, and a lot of people are doing that instead, which to me actually is much more interesting, because if you associate a wide variety of different flowers with the grasses, you get a show all year long, whereas most of your native shrubs, kind of general joke in the landscaping business is, yeah, put in these shrubs, they have white flowers in June, and then, you know, that's the deal, and they have some berries. Okay, I don't mean to demean shrubs, but they're kind of a one-trick pony. So, but they have other good aspects to them. But if you put in a variety of prairie flowers and grasses, you've got something going on May, June, July, August, September, October, November, and the grasses look great all the way into the fall. So that's one option. As far as other shrubs, there are actually some prairie shrubs that are really cool. They're not going to do the same thing as what you would think of a traditional foundation planting, though, where it obscures the foundation, which, yeah, of course, is where the name comes from. And most of your native shrubs, you've got some really good choices, like the red osier dogwood, mm-hmm, which gets about 4 to 5 feet tall. It's got beautiful red twigs. You do have to prune it back every 3 or 4 years because it gets kind of ratty, but that's not a big deal. It's pretty easy to do. There's a native prairie shrub, which is not quite as large as some of the other ones, called New Jersey tea, which will get about 2 feet tall and about 3 feet in diameter. And it needs a well-drained soil. It likes a sandy loam or a loam. It doesn't like it super dry. It doesn't like clay. And that plant has beautiful leaves. It's super drought tolerant. And it is, interestingly, pollinated mostly by flies and wasps.
Ah.
Now, we were talking about bees and wasps. Now we're going to have some flies. How about that? Boy, I'm putting that right by my door. Now, let's be very clear. You will never see a housefly on New Jersey tea. It is only pollinated by these very, very small flies that like the nectar and the pollen. The housefly, it wants, like, you know, dead stuff. Okay. It will not ever go to your New Jersey tea. And what's really interesting is, who else comes to New Jersey tea? And I couldn't figure this out. I was so dumb. I'm out there watching this, like, why is the hummingbird coming to the New Jersey tea? It doesn't have red flowers or tubular flowers. There's no nectar there for it. It was eating the flies.
Ah!
Now, you don't really think they live on that sugar water you put out, do you? Come on, you got to have a balanced diet. You got to get your meat and potatoes, go over to New Jersey tea and eat your flies, kids. And insects are the primary protein source for hummingbirds, and they've got to have that. And that's what's really cool about these prairie plants. You put in a wide variety of different prairie flowers, you create a smorgasbord for hummingbirds, because they're going to come and they're going to eat those little flies and spiders and all kinds of stuff that's in there. And it's amazing. If you spend your time, I know, rather than watch the videos and that kind of stuff and watch, you go on YouTube, go out and watch that prairie and look really closely. Bring a magnifying glass and you will be astounded at the incredible diversity of small insects, which are the foundation of the food chain for birds, for all kinds of critters. And it's just it's just amazing. And you'll see a wide variety of other really cool visitors that depend on those insects, just like the hummingbird.
We have Mike in Crawford who has a comment for you. Hi, Mike.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I got a question about unknown, I think, a prairie flower, and then a quick comment on that goldenrod eradication. I bought some topsoil from Walmart, and I blended it with some other soils, and apparently it wasn't sterilized, and I ended up with raised beds in the garden, and I put this mixture in there. And it ended up where I ended up with an unknown flower I never saw in my life before. It is about the size of a lady slipper what do you call that nectar flower the bees like? Honeysuckle.
Uh-huh.
And it, I can't remember the leaves, but the flowers look like a cone, and they're scalloped white with a little mottling and some golden detail in it. And I can't figure it out. And they came back the second year, and I just kept that tub by itself because I want to maybe transplant this thing. And it's unusual. Maybe it is a prairie version of a prairie plant. I don't know. And then on the other thing with the goldenrod, that has tubers and rhizomes. And the best is I do hay, and I had a field that had a lot of this goldenrod and purple loosestrife, which the root system is similar, and it would be easier. The more you cut it, the more it grows back. It stresses the plant out, and eventually it disappears. You can also selectively apply Roundup to it if you don't have a lot of them, but if you're talking acres, it's a different thing. But I would suggest disking the land because all you do is cut them tubers up, and you got millions more.
Yep. It's just like quackgrass with a flower.
Yep.
Yep. Creeps and crawls all over the place. Yeah, if you mow it enough, you can deprive the plant of its energy. It takes a long time, I'm assuming, right, Mike, on your situation? You had to do that for a few years, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And the problem with the prairie is that if we do that, we're going to kill the prairie plants, too. So we don't have a selective way to deal with that. And we can only mow the prairie once or twice a year without really harming the prairie. And, of course, you won't get many flowers or certain bloom periods if you're out there mowing it back all the time. But, yeah, you can certainly apply Roundup selectively, but, you know, you want to be really careful you don't have collateral damage to the good guys. But back to your flower that came in your topsoil, I'm going to be almost certain that any flower that showed up in a bag of Walmart topsoil is probably not a prairie plant, unless they got their topsoil in Kansas somewhere. But really hard to say what that is. But if you want, you can send me do you have a digital camera? You can send me a picture of that, and I can take a look at it for you.
So just send it to you at Prairie Nursery.
Yeah, just send it to Neil D, N-E-I-L, D as in David, at prairienursery.com, and I'll take a look at it.
All right, there you go.
I don't want everybody to send me pictures.
You can post some pictures on our website, or on my Facebook page. That'd be all right.
There we go.
There you go. Neil DeVoe, our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Great to have him with us here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking prairie plants today on Garden Talk, incorporating prairie and other native plants into your landscape. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Neil DeVoe, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Lots of callers online and many emails as well. Here's an email. Let's do that right now. What's the best time of the year to move prairie smoke, and how should it be separated so that the caller can give some away and replant the rest?
Oh, good. An easy question.
Yeah. Okay.
As soon as your ground is thawed in spring is the best time to move prairie smoke because it's an early blooming plant. You want to get to it before it starts to bloom and divide it. And you'll see that it has these rhizomes, usually anywhere from 2 to 4 inches long. And just break those rhizomes apart at the point where they attach, and they will never feel a thing. And I will tell you, we don't normally recommend this, but you can move prairie smoke almost any time of the year. It's a really tough plant. But for best results, get it before the leaves come out. And the leaves will come out very, very rapidly because it does emerge very soon. So I'm going to guess here probably late March, mid to late March, as soon as you can get in and work the ground. Dig them up, divide them, and just break them off. You don't have to be fancy or anything. You can take a scalpel to them, or pruning shears or something. But we just break them apart and then stick them in the ground, and they never know the difference.
All right, there we go. Mohammed in Milwaukee, we're on to you now. Thank you for calling. Hello.
Yeah, Larry, I'd like to ask you, Jeff, some of the plants, the prairie plants, can they be used for medicinal purposes, and are some of them used in the homeopathic remedies?
Mm-hmm. Well, I am not an expert at this, but of course, the classic prairie plant that is used medicinally is the echinacea,
right?
The purple coneflower. There are many different varieties, and my understanding is, from people that I've worked with, is that the different species have different strengths of the medicinal properties. And Echinacea angustifolia, which is a Western species, it's related to the pale purple coneflower, but it is a shorter variety. They used to be considered the same species, but now they're split out. However, I just saw a study 2 weeks ago, and it depends. You know, every study can say what every study says. You never know. One says this and one says that. But they did a fairly exhaustive test, and they said that they found no effect of echinacea as far as its ability, I believe, to prevent colds. So that's just one study. I'm not here to say one or the other. I'm just telling you what I read. I read it on the Internet, so it has to be true. But and I know in Germany, they also work with, besides the echinaceas, with which they work very extensively, there's another plant that they work with, and that is the wild quinine, Parthenium integrifolium. And this is a prairie plant that we grow. And we've had some interest from some people that want to grow it in Germany medicinally. I honestly do not know what it is used for. But those are the two plants that we generally see people having interest in.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Mohammed. Mark in Columbus, on to you now. Hi, Mark.
Hi, I'm wondering if you have any suggestions as to what natives might grow well under my neighbor's dirty black walnut tree.
Actually, a surprising number of native plants for shade will grow under black walnuts. And we're doing a lot of research on this, and there has been some research done. Ohio State has done some research, and you'll find that there are a surprising variety of plants that will grow under there. And we are developing a more extensive list as we test. And how do we test? Well, if you come to our display gardens northwest of Westfield, you will see that our woodland gardens are almost completely under black walnuts.
Oh.
So it's the ultimate test, okay, the survival test.
My blue stem isn't doing well.
No, your blue stem is not going to do well, number one, because it's probably in the shade, correct?
No, it's near the property line, but it does get pretty decent sun.
Okay, you get at least a half a day of full sun?
Yes.
Okay, so that should not be an issue. So you're probably seeing some problems from the active ingredient juglone, which is causing a problem. Now, I've never tested prairie plants because normally you wouldn't see those associated with the black walnuts. But on the edge, I can see how that would be a situation where it would be a problem. But most of your woodland plants, most of your native woodland plants, with some notable exceptions, will do okay in that situation. So I'd encourage you to come up. If you're not too far away, you're in Columbus. That's about an hour, a little more than an hour to our nursery. And come look at our display gardens in May or June and see what's doing and what's happening and make some decisions for yourself.
And where are you in Westfield?
We are northwest of Westfield. And you can, if you go to our website, there is a map to our retail store and our display gardens. And if you get one of our catalogs, there's also a map on the catalog as well.
Great. Thank you.
Okay,
all right.
Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have Georgia in Green Bay up next. Hi, Georgia.
Hi. Oh, I'm glad you got my call. We have our whole backyard in wildflowers, seeds that we bought from you, and it's beautiful. It's about 15 years old. But there was a small area that just never grew. And I went back to the nursery. I can't tell you the exact size. I did have the dimensions. I gave it to them, and it was around $100 for the seeds for that area. The first year, nothing came up. So, well, I got impatient, and I started mowing it. And I've been mowing it for about, well, this was maybe 3-4 years ago. I probably ruined it. Well, if I leave it, will those flowers ever come back?
Let me ask you a couple questions.
I've never had flowers there.
Okay. And this was an area that you had seeded with the original mix?
Yes.
And it, strangely, yes. Nothing came up in that area, but it came up
no.
fine. But everywhere else it came up fine, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And where do you live in Green Bay? This might tell me something about your soils. Are you on the east side, west side?
On the east side, I think you would consider it clayish.
Okay.
I don't really know.
I'm going to guess. This is just a guess, Georgia.
Uh-huh.
That maybe the topsoil in this area was lost or removed, and so you had a worse clay or a subsoil clay in this area where very little came up, and your other soil had a sufficient topsoil to provide a good seed bed and growing conditions for your flowers and grasses. That's just my guess, having lived in Green Bay for 8 years and worked on that clay, which is a very unfriendly soil.
Yes, it is. I know.
And I'm going to guess you've got some nice red clay, don't you? Is that possibly
it? No, I don't know that much about soil.
Okay. I'm just going to guess that's what happened here.
Yeah.
And going back to your mowing, at what height did you mow this at?
Well, probably an inch.
Okay.
And I've been mowing it for a few years now, but I've been listening to you, and it sounds like if you keep mowing it every year, you're going to lose the seeds or damage the seeds.
Well, the seeds are not the issue. And and remember, when you say you didn't see anything the first year, that's because these are perennials, so you won't see any flowers until the second, third, fourth, fifth year.
Yeah, I called your nursery, and that's what they told me. They said you won't see anything for 3, 4, or 5 years.
Right.
And so then I didn't mow it for a couple years,
okay.
But it just got overgrown with weeds, and
yep.
They were blowing into my other flowers, so I just gave up. And
sure.
But is there any way that I could still save those seeds, or are they gone?
They're probably gone, because what you will find is that with the prairie plants, very few of those seeds, although they can stay dormant for a couple years, maybe 3, depending on the species, some a little longer. Most of them, after about 3 years in the ground, that's pretty much it. So anything that was going to come up would have come up in the first 2 to 3 years. And then the mowing management probably would have probably would have knocked them out. So it's highly doubtful that you would see anything coming up now. I suggest that you might want to start a brick factory in that area. Because I'm kidding, of course, but I know that horrible soil up there. It's very difficult. Now, your other choice here is we have a special mix called Clay Busters. Did you use our Clay Busters mix by chance?
I don't think so. I never really discussed the soil.
Yeah.
Okay, I would investigate the soil. Soil is everything in this game, and this is so, so important. You want to match your mix to the soil type, and that's why we classify our mixes like dry soil, sandy, gravelly, rocky soils, or medium soils, which are like loam, sandy loam, silt loams, and then clay soils and moist soils. So it's so super important that you match the seed mix up to the soil because we have selected the plants that will grow in those conditions. And we have a mix called the Clay Busters. And how do I know that that's the Clay Busters? Because when I managed the Arboretum at University of Wisconsin-Green Bay back in the early Pleistocene, we built a pond, and it was pure red clay with no topsoil from the spoils. And I planted like 50 different species of prairie seed on it, just as an experiment. And the species that came up were the ones that became the Clay Busters. And very, very important, if you do have this heavy clay, put at least an inch of straw mulch, clean straw, not hay. Don't do what I did the first time I used mulch. I went in the barn and found this bales of straw of hay. Oh, wow, look at this free hay. I'll use this on my prairie project. Oh, my God, I had weeds up the wazoo. Big problem. So you want to get clean straw, like winter wheat straw. Put about an inch to an inch and a half of straw over the seed when you're on, and this works for any soil, but it's particularly important on clay because what happens with clay is when it dries out, there is no way those roots can penetrate into that brick below. And the straw maintains the soil moisture, and if you can water it, all the better because, you know, every couple days, whenever the surface of the soil dries out, that maintains soil moisture so those roots can penetrate that soil and get started. These are the two critical aspects to getting the plants going. Pick the right plants for the soil. In the case of clay, put the straw over it and keep it damp for the first 60 days, and then you will get establishment and with much better results. So check your soil, and then if you're going to redo it, make sure you get the right mix for it and put a little straw in there and get out the sprinkler.
All right. Thank you. Good
luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We got an email from Gigi in Chippewa County. I know that growing St. John's wort may be a risk in that it can be invasive if not controlled. However, what are the pros and cons of including it in a permaculture garden farm project? And is it a companion plant to any other plants?
Oh, boy. We're moving out of my area of expertise. And just to clarify, there are many different species of St. John's wort. It's the genus Hypericum. And there are actually some native Hypericums. I think the one you're probably talking about is probably Hypericum perforatum, which is the one that is often used medicinally. And honest to God, I don't really know much about this. And permaculture is kind of out of my area. So I really am just going to kind of punt on this one.
No problem. Here's a much easier question. What are the strongest, natural, and most effective methods to eliminate Japanese beetles?
Oh, Larry. Get some wasps. I don't know. We're very fortunate. The Japanese beetle line is still south of us. I have not had to go mano a mano with Japanese beetles. And you know, that's a Phil Pelletieri question right there. And I'm sorry. I'm not being of the entomological persuasion.
That's all right. What about... how to tell native flocks from non-native varieties? Genevieve wants to know.
Oh, that's a really good question. Okay. And a lot of times what people see along the roadside is not a phlox at all. It's a member of the cabbage family blooming in May with these beautiful purple-pink flowers.
Yeah.
And it is not a phlox at all. It's actually an invasive biennial. I can't think of the name of it now. Everybody else out there knows it, but it's not actually a phlox. There are most of the phlox you will see are native, and creeping phlox, for instance, is a native plant to the eastern United States, and many people plant it here in their gardens. So it's not truly native to Wisconsin. It's been moved from the Appalachian Mountains where it's native to, but it typically does fine for most people if you have the right growing condition. You know, it needs a really well-drained, sandy, rocky soil. It doesn't grow well in clay. So the best way is to get yourself a wildflower book and spend some time out there and learn them. But I can never remember the name of that doggone plant. But here's how you tell the difference, okay? Phlox have five petals on their flowers.
Oh.
Okay. And the non-native phlox-like plant, being a member of the mustard family, has four petals, and it has six stamens, two of which are exerted above the other four. So we can get into some pretty technical botany. Can't remember the name of the plant, but I can tell you all about the floral structure. So, but that's how you tell. The phlox have five, and the things that look like phlox blooming in May have only four petals. That's a dead giveaway.
All right, let's go to Diana in Sparta next. Hi, Diana.
Good afternoon. I am wondering what you would recommend. I have a huge area that's mainly sand and rocky. We hauled in dirt on one area that wasn't quite so steep, and we planted, you know, nice blooming flowers. But what would you recommend that I would not have to spend a lot of labor and time to do with the rest of this sandy, rocky area?
Okay, you know what? This is the perfect, perfect question, Diana, because we can save our customers so much money by picking the right plants or the right seed mix for dry sand, because there are so many wonderful native prairie flowers and grasses that will grow in this horrible sand that you swear to God nothing in its right mind could ever, ever survive on. You pick the right plants, and we have some great mixes for dry sandy soils that will grow in that condition at no cost to you for extra topsoil. And usually what you will find is the cost of topsoil will be 2 to 3 times the cost of the seed. And a lot of times people, and this is a real big, big problem, people will bring in 6 inches of loam or, you know, silt loam over the sand, which goes down, you know, 100 feet of dry sand. And it's like, okay, now what do I do? Do I pick a medium soil mix to match the loam? Or, well, it's going to dry out because of all that sand under there. I have a schizophrenic soil. It doesn't know what it is anymore. It's dry sand underneath, but it's loam, nice loam on top. Well, what am I going to do? The plants don't know what to do. If you put a dry sandy mix on there, many of the dry species will not grow in the loam because of the wrong moisture conditions, etc. So it can be much more confusing. And if you put a medium mix on it, it only has 6 inches of topsoil, and a lot of these prairie plants have roots that go 6, 8, 10, 15 feet deep. So the actual conditions under which they are going to grow will be determined mostly by the subsoil. So don't move, don't put any topsoil on it. You'll be farther ahead. And pick a nice prairie mix that's designed for dry, sandy soils. And there's some great options for you in that. There's low ones, there's mediums, there's tall ones, and even our butterfly mix. We have a butterfly mix for dry soil. So you got a lot of options. So check them out and see which one's best for you.
There you go.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have a caller from Holman, who wanted to know if there are native plants or bushes that could serve as a winter wind barrier.
Native plants or bushes for a winter wind barrier. Well, there's a lot of different plants that you can select from for that. Most of our native shrubs are going to be deciduous. We don't have a lot of coniferous shrubs that are going to, number one, serve as a wind barrier. And because we don't have that many conifers from which to choose in the first place. And the ones that are commonly planted, like some of your white cedars, okay, these are deer candy. And you'll notice if you look at white cedars, they will be, they have these perfect little lines about 8 feet up, and there's no vegetation, no leaves under that 8 feet, because that's as far, that's as high as a deer can go on its hind legs. And if you put anything in that's not already 10 or 12 feet tall, you'll have nothing because they will tear it up. Unless you don't have deer. Unless you have, you know, fence around your property, which is about the only way you won't have deer in Wisconsin these days. So you can look at some of the viburnums and a lot of the dogwoods. And it really is going to depend upon how much space you have, what kind of look you want, what kind of height you want. There's also a great plant called ninebark, Physocarpus, which gets 5 to 8 feet tall. And it's a great bird plant. The birds love the seeds. So there, those are just a few examples. You can put in, if you want a really thick screen and you have a lot of area, you can put in gray dogwood, which will get usually 6 to 10 feet tall.
Yeah.
And it will creep by rhizomes. It's pretty aggressive, so be careful. Once you put gray dogwood in, you have to be ready to have gray dogwood. And it will form a nice thick screen. And a really cool thing is you can establish it, like plant it in a circle if you have a lot of room, and you can make like a room inside that. It's really pretty cool. Yeah, it's really interesting. So there's a lot of them to choose from. So I would suggest that you do a little research and see what some of your native shrubs are, and then you can select the ones that are going to be best for your situation based upon your height and the size of your area that you're working with and other factors that are of importance to your landscape.
That flower you were trying to think of, was it Sweet Rocket?
Yes, Dame's Rocket.
Dame's Rocket.
Dame's Rocket. Yes, Hesperus matronalis. See, I can think of a Latin name, but the doggone common name escapes me. Hesperus matronalis, the Dame's Rocket. You got it. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
We have another question from Kristen wondering, what is a good ground cover for a very wet, shady area that goes well with moss?
Ooh, well, if you have moss, that's usually telling us that you probably have an imbalance of nutrients or pH in your soil, generally speaking, or it may just be a function of the moisture. The question is it sphagnum moss? Or do you have a boggy situation, and so it's dominated by some of the sphagnums or related mosses? Or is it because you have a high pH? And most of your mosses will grow in a high pH situation, oftentimes in a low nutrient situation. But often you'll see a very high pH, like 4.5 or 5.5. You'll see these extremely acid conditions, and that's where moss will grow, and things like grass don't like it because they can't get the nutrients that they want. So the first thing I would do is check your pH and see what's going on, because we can't make any plant decisions until we understand.
Get a soil test.
And every time, you know, that's the first question I ask a client, what's your soil, what's your soil, what's your soil, what's growing there, and what's your soil? Because that can tell us a lot about what your conditions are, and then we can figure out, do we need to correct those conditions to grow the plants that you want to grow? So I would love to answer that question, but without more information, I really couldn't give you a good recommendation.
Here's sort of on another matter. You have formed or working with others to form a progressive business alliance.
Yes.
Neil, I wondered about that.
Well, yeah, this is just, we just started this on Saturday night. Okay, we've been doing this 6 days now. It's happened very, very fast. But a lot of us have been small business owners and people that have businesses that are focused on improving the environment or providing healthy food, what we call progressive businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And we've been really frustrated with the political situation and climate, not only in our state, but in the United States for the last few years. And we came to the conclusion is, you know what, let's quit sitting around moaning and groaning about it, and let's do something. So we have formed a progressive business alliance that was designed to unite people who have similar ideas and want to band together and share their experiences, form a community, and basically it's going to be an online community, but we'll get together in person, but this could grow all over the country, for people that want to purchase from like-minded businesses, and rather than spending their money on businesses who put profits before people, and to really work to develop our communities on a small scale, and to have a political voice, because right now we're not represented as small businesses and as progressive businesses. We're not represented by the Chamber of Commerce or Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. And so everybody thinks that business owners don't care about their employees or don't care about the environment, but there's thousands of us out there that do. So we put this together so that we can band together and be heard, have a voice in the social and political forum, and to learn from each other and to share information and learn how we can do things better, and just become stronger together as individual companies and as people with like-minded values.
And you already have a website?
The website is under construction, but we do have a Facebook page. That's a lot easier to do. So if you want to check out our Facebook page, go to Progressive Business Alliance of America. And if you like it, tell us you like it and post something. This is going to be really interesting, and we're going to have memberships, which, again, will be on our website. When it comes up, we'll have memberships. And we decided to keep it as reasonable as possible. So for businesses under $1 million of gross income a year, the membership will be $100 a year, and then it'll be a sliding scale. You go up. But we'll also have a $25 associate membership where people who don't own businesses but are interested in this can join for a very modest annual fee. So we're hoping that this will grow here first in Wisconsin, and then continue throughout the country so we can bring people together that really want to get together to promote progressive businesses.
So Progressive Business Alliance?
Progressive Business Alliance of America. There put that go. In your Facebook page and see what comes up. We'd love to hear from you, and hope you'll join us.
Thanks, Neil. Neil DeBull of Prairie Nursery of Westfield, Wisconsin, our guest.